It was 1965, just a few months before California Dreamin' became a reality. John Phillips, Michelle Gilliam, Denny Dougherty, and Cass Elliott, village expatriates all, turned up and plugged in L.A. You know where that's at.
Everyone was getting sort of tired of reproducing traditional material and felt like, you know, it was time to write their own material and express themselves and rise or fall on their own merits, not on how well they could reproduce something that had happened in the 30s or in the 20s, and the Dust Bowl music and things like that. And then when the Beatles came along and started doing intelligent music and harmonies that were acceptable to folk musicians, you know, who were used to using a lot of minor chords and diminished chords and so forth in their own music, and proved that it could be palatable to the public. And there was a mass influx suddenly of intelligent musicians and writers into the pop field. You gotta go where you wanna go.
The title of the first album is exactly the way I felt when I first saw him. I couldn't believe it. To see four people like that put together, he had this long, tall guy playing guitar and a beautiful, mystic-looking blonde and mother of nature, whatever Cass has been called, and Earl Flynn. You know, they were like out of another age.
It was Barry McGuire, you'll recall, who brought them together. Adler, the producer, and the Mamas and Papas.
I put out a record, which isn't very widely known, called Go Where You Want to Go and the Mamas and Papas. And it was out, about 2 days. And we went in to do the McGuire album. This precious time.
We had just signed with Dunhill. We were going to sing background to Barry's album. And California Dreaming was one of the songs that Barry was going to do on his album. So we did the track and so forth, and we did the background vocals, and it sounded like a complete record, except for the second verse solo, which Denny eventually put on.
And as I started to do the background, I just knew that this was the record for the Mamas and Papas. All the leaves are brown, and the sky is gray. I've been for a while.
Down on my knees.
took McGuire outside and I said, Barry, this should be their single. And Barry's, you know, if I would have said, Barry, I want your house, he would say, here, you know, that's the kind of guy Barry is. He said, great, you know, take it.
Barry said, gosh, why don't you guys just do it yourselves, you know? He said, it's already done. I said, why should I even sing against this, you know? Which was very grand of Barry, and really kicked us off.
So that night we finished it up and stopped pressing the other record, which turned out later to be a Fifth Dimension hit.
Barry used a harmonica in there, and we used a flute. Yeah, as a matter of fact, if you ever get Barry's album, that album, it's the same exact instrumental track, except for that one thing, and we're singing in the background exactly the same way as did on our record. You know? I think basically the folk musician had a much better grounded knowledge of basic musical technique than the average rock and roll musician had, and a much more traditional standard of values as far as lyricism and situations about which to write. Because the folk songs themselves, you know, are a result of what is called the folk process, you know, where a song, no one knows who wrote it really. It, sort of come down from generation to generation, has been refined and refined, and a word lifted here, another word put in there. And eventually you have an immortal song, because it's been worked on by maybe 1,000 people over a 100-year period.
The depth of their lyrics is the most important thing. So a lyric like California Dreamin', the depth of it is an extension of folk. You didn't just have to say, it's blue and I love you and so forth. You could say it poetically.
It comes down to very basic elemental situations as far as storyline of the lyric is concerned. And I think most of the writers, the successful writers, Sebastian and the Beatles and Dylan, myself, Paul Simon, all sort of realize these basic human situations, you know, much in the way that a good novelist would, or someone who has to write a really a true story. The song is a song is sort of like, you know, the essence of the short story. I mean, you have 3 minutes to do the whole thing. You know.
But between sundown's finish and midnight's broken tone, we duck inside the doorway, thunder crashing. As majestic bells and bones struck shadows in the sound, seeming to be the chimes of freedom flashing. Rushing for the warriors whose strength is not to fight. Flashing for the refugees on the unarmed road of flight. And for each and every underdog soldier in the night. And we gazed upon the chimes of freedom flashing. Even though a cloud's white curtain in a far-off corner flashed, and the hypnotic splattered mist was slowly lifting, the electric light still struck like arrows fired before the ones condemned to drift, or else be kept from drifting. Tolling for the searching ones on their speechless seeking trail. For the lonesome-hearted lovers with too personal a tale. And for each unharmful, gentle soul misplaced inside a jail. And we gazed upon the chimes of freedom flashing. Find no track of ours, for they hang suspended. As we listen one last time, and we watch with one last look, spellbound and swallowed till the tolling ended. Tolling for the aching ones whose wounds cannot be nursed. Strung out ones and worse, and for every hung up person in the whole wide universe, and we gazed upon the chimes of freedom flashing.
In a moment, a preview of the next chapter in John Gilliland's The Pop Chronicles.